I'm James McIlvenny, and you're listening to the History and Philosophy of the Language Sciences podcast, online at hifilangsci.net. There you can find links and references to all the literature we discuss. In the previous episode, we spoke about Franz Boas and his contributions to the study of American languages, and of the development of the modern fields of anthropology and linguistics in America more generally. In this episode, we're going to zoom out and take a panoramic view of the documentation and description of the indigenous languages of the Americas. To guide us through this topic, we're joined today by Marcin Kolarski, Professor of English Linguistics at the University of Poznan. Marcin has just published a book on the very subject of this episode, his 2021 History of the Study of the Indigenous Languages of North America. So Marcin, can you draw back the curtain for us on the grand vista of the description of the languages of the Americas? When did the documentation and description of American languages start? And are there identifiable periods and schools in the study of American languages? And if so, what are their defining features?
Hi, James. Thanks for having me. So the description of North American languages has a long history going back to the first word list of St. Lawrence Iroquoian, another Iroquoian language that was spoken along the St. Lawrence River and which were compiled in the 1530s. And these were followed during the 16th century by vocabularies of languages belonging to the Algonquin and the Eskimo Aleut families spoken in North Carolina and on Baffin Island, respectively. So we're looking at nearly five centuries of documentation and description, and what can be described as complex, heterogeneous tradition that is only marginally shorter than the study of Mesoamerican languages, and includes several local or national traditions, such as the French, British, and Danish traditions. Note, by the way, that I'm using the term North America with reference to the indigenous languages and cultures north of the civilizations of central Mexico. So three periods are usually distinguished in the history of the Americanist tradition. The first period extends from the 1530s until the late 18th century. It is often referred to as the missionary period, since most scholars who worked on the languages were missionaries, but the languages were also described by explorers and other scholars. Since the period covers over 250 years, we can distinguish several phases within it, depending on the time, location, and richness of scholarship, but also the background of the commentators and the phenomena they were concerned with. Thus, the 16th century word lists that I've mentioned were followed by grammatical descriptions of Algonquian and Iroquoian languages in the 17th century, including the reports from missionaries in New France that were published in the Jesuit Relations, and the Grammar of Massachusetts by John Eliot, published in 1666, and finally grammars of Greenlandic and vocabularies of the languages of the Southeast that appeared in the second half of the 18th century. The second, much shorter period, extends from 1788, that is, from the publication of the Grammar of Mohican by Jonathan Edwards, Jr., till the 1840s, a decade that witnessed growing institutionalization of scholarship in the United States and the establishment of several societies, such as the American Ethnological Society and the American Oriental Society, both founded in 1842, as well as the Smithsonian Institution, founded in 1846. For many reasons, this short period deserves to be treated separately. Several original descriptions were published in this period, including the grammar by Edwards that I just mentioned, together with editions of earlier studies published by Peter Stephen de Ponsor and John Pickering, both of whom corresponded with Wilhelm von Humboldt, whose grammars of Massachusetts, Mohican, and Onondaga have recently been published. These scholars made an important contribution to linguistics. For example, Jonathan Edwards proposed at a lecture given in 1787 that Algonquian languages are related as, to quote, dialects of the same original language, unquote. And this happened before the publication in 1788 of the famous statement by Sir William Jones about the common source of Sanskrit and European languages. Our present understanding of polysynthetic languages largely derives from this period, as it was de Ponsor who introduced the term polysynthetic with reference to a manner of compounding or combination of concepts that are expressed in other languages by several words. According to him, This was a common characteristic of, to quote, all the Indian languages from Greenland to Cape Horn, unquote. And finally, the third period extends from the mid-19th century to the present. In the context of the institutionalization of linguistics and anthropology in the mid-19th century, one should also mention the Bureau of Ethnology, founded in 1879 and subsequently renamed as the Bureau of American Ethnology. Seminal contributions were made in this period to the classification of North American languages by Albert Gallatin and John Wesley Powell. Powell himself saw Gallatin's synopsis of the Indian tribes as the beginning of a new era. In turn, the arrival of Franz Boas in the United States in 1886 can be said to mark the end of the shift in American linguistics at the beginning of a continuous tradition that lasts to the present day and encompasses the work of Boas and his students, in particular Edward Sapir, as well as such scholars as Leonard Bloomfield and Charles Hockett. The research carried out in this period reflects the preoccupations of early scholars, which can be described as the defining features of the Americanist tradition. These include an emphasis on fieldwork and collaboration with indigenous consultants, together with the early inclusion of women scholars such as Amini Adele Smith and Alice Cunningham Fletcher. Viewed from the present perspective, Marianne Muthoni in her paper on Native American languages at the threshold of the new millennium, found in the forthcoming Volume 1 of the Handbook of North American Indians, concludes that, to quote, the indigenous languages are now cherished more than ever across North America, unquote, with extensive work on documentation, description, maintenance, and revitalization that is often carried out in collaboration between indigenous consultants and outside linguists.
So what challenges did scholars coming from European grammatical traditions face when they were describing the languages of the Americas?
So what I tried to do in my book was to trace the history of the description of these languages through the lens of some of their most characteristic features, including the sound systems, morphology and syntax, and the lexicon, and focusing in each case on the challenges that scholars have faced. Although we deal with different kinds of issues regarding different components of language structure, in many cases the challenges are interrelated. In the first place, up until the late 19th century, describing sounds in unwritten languages was hindered by an absence of basic tools and terms, such as methods of phonetic transcription and an understanding of phonemic contrast and different types of variation. This had consequences for the description of languages with phonetic inventories that were both more and less complex than those found in the European languages, and which in both cases were evaluated in terms of typical European inventories or other alphabets due to an orthographic understanding of phonology. Several enduring motives can be distinguished in phonetic accounts, for example, the notion that sounds lack consistency or fixedness. The motive goes back to Gabriel Sagard's account of variation in pronunciation in his urine phrasebook of 1632, where he mentioned an instability of language, unquote. According to John Stackley, Sagard, in fact, recorded not only distinct dialects of Huron, but speakers of another language, St. Lawrence Iroquoian. However, his comments were frequently mentioned in reports on languages viewed as primitive or exotic. As you showed in a recent paper published in 2019, this interpretation was eventually dismissed by Boas as an effect of the native language of the commentators. And finally, inaccurate phonetic analysis made it impossible to describe the structure of words, and since the languages have complex polysyntactic morphology, to understand how they express lexical and grammatical meanings. So morphology and syntax pose another challenge, and here we need to emphasize the degree of complexity that we're dealing with in most North American languages. In a paper in the 2017 Handbook of Polysynthesis, Peter Trudgill has usefully collected expressions that linguists use to describe the complexity of polysynthetic languages, including the adjectives exuberant, daunting, spectacular, and legendary. Considering the fact that even with the terminological baggage that we now equipped, the analysis of polysynthetic words is a difficult task, it's amazing how well some pre-20th century scholars coped with it, including the first grammatical accounts from the 17th century. For example, French missionaries working on Huron described it as complex and beautiful. Jean de Brebeuf, in his 1636 Relation, referred to the variety of what he called compound words as, to quote, the key to the secret of their language, unquote. Gabriel Sagard made similar comments about Huron, but future readers of his phrasebook preferred to cite his more negative evaluations of the language, such as his reference to, quote, a savage language, almost without rules and likewise imperfect, unquote, and also his comments about the lack of consistency in pronunciation. Similar to the effects of inaccurate phonetic analysis that I've mentioned, inaccurate morphological analysis hindered the description of lexical meanings. In a common motive, verb forms expressing grammatical meanings were interpreted as different verbs or different words. This allowed further reinterpretations, where languages such as Cherokee were attributed with an abundance of specific terms as well as a lack of generic terms, both assumed characteristics viewed as evidence of their poverty. Such evaluations of Cherokee are common until the 20th century and complement a related notion according to which the languages lack abstract terms. Challenges in descriptions of vocabulary are also illustrated by the Eskimo words for snow, a paragon example of sloppy methodology that encapsulates several typical features of the examples that I discuss in the book. These include complex life cycles and their history, a rhetorical versatility that allows commentators to employ them as evidence of often contradictory claims about the languages and their speakers, and finally, a certain timelessness of linguistic examples and the related stereotypes of the speakers that are disconnected from their present nature.
Can you tell us what linguistic scholarship or linguistic innovations, if I can put it that way, were made by speakers of American languages themselves? So one famous example is perhaps the Cherokee syllabary invented by Sequoia. Could you tell us about this and other comparable efforts?
Yes, you're right. The Cherokee syllabary is the most famous example. It's amazing how quickly it was adopted by the Cherokees in the 1820s and how it contributed to a rich literary tradition and a sense of national identity. Several periodicals were printed in the syllabary, one of which, the Cherokee Advocate, was published with one break up until the early 20th century. The syllabary is also familiar to non-linguists. Street signs in the syllabary are part of the linguistic landscape in North Carolina and Oklahoma, and most users of Apple computers are familiar with the Cherokee font that has long been supplied with the operating system. It's worth looking at the historical context of the development and history of the syllabary. In 1838, most Cherokees who were still living in their traditional homeland in the southern Appalachia were forcibly removed to what is now the state of Oklahoma on the Trail of Tears, which resulted in a heavy loss of life, similar to the other forced removals of the other so-called five civilized tribes of the Southeast. There are many poignant reports of the removal, for instance, by the missionary Daniel Buttrick, who accompanied the Cherokees on the death march. It's also striking to compare the literature printed in the syllabary with the context in which the Cherokee language was typically mentioned in European publications in linguistic ethnology and sociology in the second half of the 19th century. If we look at these surveys, for example, the Principles of Sociology by the British sociologist Herbert Spencer, we'll find a reference to the Cherokees as one of the so-called inferior races that are not capable of abstract thought, and so their language abounds in specific vocabulary. This is one of the common misconceptions I've mentioned earlier. But apart from the Cherokee syllabary, there are also other writing systems that were developed indigenously. There is, for example, the Great Lakes Algonquian syllabary. I only mention it in my book, but Lucy Thomason recently gave a paper about it at a session documenting the contribution of the Smithsonian Institution to American linguistics. There's a large corpus of literature in Meskwaki written in the syllabary, known as Papi Pipo, which was collected for the Bureau of American Ethnology by Truman Michelson and is now found in the Smithsonian's National Anthropological Archives. The manuscripts have been a source of grammars, dictionaries, and collections of stories compiled by several generations of scholars, for example, Bloomfield's 1946 Sketch of Algonquian. As for linguistic work by indigenous scholars, I've already suggested that collaboration with indigenous consultants can be seen as one of the defining features of the Americanist tradition. One should mention John Napoleon Brinton Hewitt, a part Tuscarora staff member of the Bureau of Ethnology and later the Bureau of American Ethnology. Hewitt initially worked as a consultant to Hermione Smith, but later became an authority in Iroquoian studies. He He's now most known for his two-volume Iroquoian cosmology. Heward was a very gifted linguist, but unfortunately, he left little published theoretical work, basically one paper on polysynthesis published in 1893. His uneven career at the Bureau has been attributed to various factors, including a lack of college education, his indigenous heritage, poor communication skills and attention to detail, as well as the negative response to his paper on polysynthesis by Daniel Garrison Brinton, professor of archaeology and linguistics at the University of Pennsylvania and president in 1894 of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. An apt description of Heward's status was given by William John McGee, Heward's mentor at the Bureau, who described him as, to quote, handicapped by unsatisfactory literary methods and practically no ability to express himself orally, unquote, but second only to Franz Boas among American scholars in his linguistic knowledge. And finally, there are indigenous scholars who worked with Boas, including William Jones, whose work on Meskwaki was continued by Truman Michelson after Jones was killed while doing fieldwork in the Philippines. More well known is Ella Cara Deloria, who worked with Boas until his death in 1942, and with Ruth Benedict till her death in 1948. Her writings fall into three categories: linguistic, in particular the collection of myths and tales, Dakota texts, and the Dakota grammar, which she co-authored with Boas, as well as ethnographic studies and a work of fiction, the novel Water Lily, published in 1988. These works were written for different audiences, lay and professional, but all result from a wish to preserve and disseminate knowledge about her people, as documented by herself in conversations and interviews. In summary, indigenous scholars have made an important contribution to linguistics, which, however, remains poorly known to a wider audience. There are many scholars whose life and work deserve interest, and it seems it's now time someone told the story of nearly five centuries of indigenous scholarship, in a way to go beyond what I've tried to do in my history of European and American scholarship in general.
Well, thank you very much for this tour of American scholarship.
Great, thanks. I really enjoyed it.